and November sale is opportunity. Really excited about the changes we've made to the Horses of Racing Age portion of the sale. The timing of the Horses of Racing Age section is really well suited to the industry.
It allows us to build for the future, and the future is bright.
The future is bright at Gamelan November.
Good morning. It is 9:15 Wednesday, November 17th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News.
Good morning. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. And if you pick up today's Thoroughbred Daily News, you'll see that Sleepy Eyes Todd has been retired at Swifty Farms in Indiana. He is, of course, the winner of the 2020 Bosselman Pump and Pantry Gus Fahner Stakes at Fahner Park.
Wow, that you really reached deep in your research to find that one. That was very impressive.
Thank
you, intrepid editor slash cub reporter Bill Finley comes up with another one. Jonathan Green, general manager of DJ Stable. And guys, I don't know if you realize this, but we only have 5 shows left in 2021. 5 shows left. So we're at the equivalent of being at the top of the stretch right now. And I think we're 3 lengths in front.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. The Keeneland November sale is still going on, still got chances to bid through this Friday. Friday will be after the final session of the breeding stock sale. We have the Horses of Racing Age portion. There's been a ton of demand at the Keeneland sale. On Sunday, with about five sessions to go, they eclipsed the 2020 Keeneland November gross number, which is monstrous. That's took them half the sale to do more business than they did last year. So that was pretty impressive. And as I said, the Horses of Racing Age portion on Friday, a lot of attention, has a total of 290 horses cataloged that will sell following the conclusion of the breeding stock sale that day. John, I know you've been home, but I know you've been paying attention to Keeneland November. How has it been trying to buy horses there?
It's been nearly impossible, Joe. We literally had 71 broodmares on our list through book 4 that we wanted to bid on or were interested in. And I like to think that we have a pretty good chance at a lot of these broodmares, based on our homework and due diligence and everything. And I can honestly tell you that not only didn't I get a bid on over 50 of them, but I got outrun by far on the majority of them. That's how strong the market is right now. We did come home with one. And I really think the only reason why we got that one was because she was in there as a broodmare racing prospect and she had an issue with her x-rays. And I think a lot of people just, didn't even look at her as a broodmare prospect. But otherwise, we were like 1 for 71. It was like my statistics in dating before I got married. I was, 1 for 71 was like the benchmark for me. To say it was strong is even an understatement, by today's, metrics. So congratulations to Keeneland for assembling such a strong group of mares and broodmare prospects. And then we also, Joe, you mentioned there's almost 300 horses of racing age that'll be selling on Friday. We have about half a dozen in there, including, graded stake winning proven strategies. And we actually put some of our better racehorses in there because the market is just so strong that we see this as an opportunity to try to monetize. So kudos to Keeneland. They reassembled and reshuffled the deck as far as the way that they set up their sale. And I think that people are really more comfortable with the online bidding. All those changes and have really increased the opportunities for Keeneland. And like you said, they broke their record midway through the sale. I mean, that's crazy.
So Friday, the Green Group has proven strategies to get you to the winner's circle next year. So last week was our big show with Travis Tiger and Tessa Muir and the whole USADA releasing their anti-doping guidelines and rules, the first set of rules. Last time we had Travis on, we did like a little bit of a recap and reaction segment because it was such a heady interview. We kind of wanted time to figure out, what takeaways we had from there. So we're going to do that a little bit again here. And I'll just start by saying I honestly feel a lot worse this time than after the first interview. And it has nothing to do with Travis or Tessa, who I think are extremely competent people. And frankly, like I've said before, it's a godsend that people this competent are coming to save the day, or at least trying to save the day in horse racing, because we have done literally nothing to deserve that kind of competence and that kind of enforcement to clean up our sport. But nevertheless, they have tasked themselves with doing so. And I think that that is such a blessing. And it's so indicative of what a mess racing is, that we have people suing left and right to stop them from taking the reins, you know, especially because now that these rules have been released, there's chance for public comment. There's an initial public comment period. And then when the rules are submitted to the FTC, there's another public comment period that can influence the rules going forward. I think that part is why Travis kept saying, if we take over, if we're in charge of this at the end. And how many times he said that kind of worried me, and it kind of seemed very ominous that he's expecting there to be so much pushback and so much watering down of the rules going forward that it's not going to be something that he and Tessa and the rest of USADA can stand behind. And that would be a tragedy, honestly, because this is something that has been sorely needed in racing for a really long time. You can quibble with some of the individual rules. You're going to have, like I said, you're going to have the chance to have feedback and to, you know, exert influence and to make comments. And, you know, it's not, here's the rules and this is the way it's going to be going forward. There's a chance for some back and forth, at least a little bit. So there's really no need to be suing. You can be part of this process. It's not too late. But yet, the fact that Travis kept saying over and over, maybe if we're in charge at the end, leads me to believe that some people in racing are so obstinate and so bullheaded and so myopic that they can't look past 6 inches in front of their face and think, well, I might be doing well, but the rest of the industry isn't doing so well, so maybe I should get on board with this reform. I think it's unlikely, and I think it's at the very least, it's not going to be in place by July 1st. I'm hoping that it'll be in place eventually. But at last time, after talking to Travis, I felt way better about the future of the sport. This time, unfortunately, I felt worse. Bill, what do you think?
Yeah, Joe, I hear what you're saying about that. And I agree with you on a lot of things you said, but I do think at the end of the day, everything will work out. I also don't think there's a prayer that it's going to happen on July 1st of next year. But so let's, you know, put that aside and you know, the things we learned from talking to Travis Tigert. And, you know, what we learned is that these guys mean business and they're going to do things the right way. And, you know, in my week in review in the TDN, I recapped some of the things that I thought were, you know, major developments. First of all, they're going to go above and beyond testing. And, you know, testing doesn't catch anybody. It catches a guy with a butobrix. That's it. It never, ever catches anybody with a serious drug. So, you know, they're going to do out of competition testing. They're going to, rely on tip lines. They're going to do all sorts of just old fashioned detective work to try to catch people. The second thing is that they are aware of the fact that the vets have a lot to do with this. There weren't a lot of specifics on this, but the whole idea that they're talking about going after the vets and the owners as well is something that I think is very, very important. And then the other one, and I was a little bit actually surprised by this, is that the idea, I called it, you know, being snarky, I called it the Bob Baffert rule in the TDN. But if you get more than 4 overages of what are called the minor infractions, which are essentially overages of therapeutic medications, you'd be subject to a 2-year suspension. And think of all the trainers, the big time trainers in this sport, that in any period of time would run the risk of this based on past performances. And I can think of 3 right off the top of my head. That's Bob Baffert, Doug O'Neill, and Steve Asmussen. And you know, I'm sure there's more that, you know, they get a lot of these things. I mean, I don't think, you know, what they're caught doing is all that serious. But if you put them all together, I mean, could we see a day where some of these bigger name trainers, you know, they better clean up the mess and better stop being sloppy with all these therapeutic overages?
I couldn't agree with both of you more. I had the same takeaways from the interview. I don't know if I was as optimistic as Bill or as kind of pessimistic as Joe. Maybe that's the right word, which I think is usually the opposite. Usually it's Bill that's a little bit more pessimistic and Joe is a little bit more optimistic. But either way, you know, I'm here to kind of balance it out. And guys, my other takeaway from this whole set of rules and recommendations is just that it's a negotiation, and they know that they're not going to have everyone on board at first blush. So they made the rules extremely onerous, which I'm in favor of. You know, and Bill, whether it's 4 strikes and you're out, or 3 strikes, or you're out for 2 years, or maybe 6 months, whatever it is, this is just kind of, you know, fleshing it out and putting the details out there of the worst case scenarios, knowing that they're probably going to have to walk back some of the rules. They're going to certainly pull back on some of the penalties, because I don't think that they're going to get universal approval for that. But that's all it is. It's just kind of framework of a negotiation. And July 1st, 2022 is not a realistic goal, but I know they have to put down some kind of deadline in order to shoot for. But I'm actually still leaving, reading the rules and the interview that we did with Travis and Tessa. I still feel good about the fact that there are sheriffs that are coming into town that are cleaning up our collective messes. And, I hate the term cancel culture. I hate it. But it's like our industry is caught up in that as well. So many people would rather shoot down any ideas than come up with ideas. And it's not just for medications. We're going to talk about, some wagering issues that occurred at the Breeders' Cup. We're going to talk about, a couple other items where, it's hard to come up with solutions to these complex questions. And I wish that as an industry, if not as a culture, we would get better about being more creative and trying to figure out ways to be proactive in making things better rather than shooting down immediately everything that comes up, from the one or two groups or individuals who are willing to go out there and try to make a solution for us.
Yeah. And, I agree that if they take charge, if this gets put into place within a reasonable time frame, I do feel good because I think the adults are in the room now. And, the thing I said about the myopia in racing is like, there's just so many people in racing who, it's working out for them. So they don't want to change anything. Like everything is all good for a certain subset of people at the top of, top 1% or top 10% of racing that they can't see beyond 6 inches in front of their face and think, well, if I'm doing well normally, but most people aren't, maybe the sport doesn't have a healthy future and we should try to do something about it. There just aren't enough people like that in racing. There are just so many, self-involved, self-centered people. And that's what comes with having such splintered leadership and having 30 different racing jurisdictions. Everybody's got, their own pockets of interest. Everyone's got their own conflicts. And it's just, it's something that is not conducive to cohesive leadership. And I go back to people who are suing to stop Heiser from coming into being. Like, what's your alternative? What is your realistic alternative to this, where we can get uniform drug enforcement and we can get like a uniform standard so that people aren't suspended for tiny overages and lumped in with cheaters, and so the FBI doesn't have to come in and find the actual cheaters? Like, there's no plausible alternate solution. And I think you should be tasked with coming up with that if you're suing to stop this thing that I think, to racing's credit, most people in the industry have gotten behind. I think it's a minority that is against this. Unfortunately, kind of a microcosm for the country right now, the minority is extremely loud. It's the extremely unsilent minority that's making all the trouble right now. And that's going to be a problem going forward. And, it seemed ominous that Travis kept saying, if we're in charge, like, I really hope they are. And I think, there's no, like I said, my pessimism from last week is not from listening to Travis or Tessa. Like, they are very extremely impressive, competent people. And, we'd be blessed to have them in charge of the drug enforcement. But I just think there are too many selfish idiots in this game, unfortunately, that it's going to be a struggle. We're going to have to drag a lot of people kicking and screaming into this new future, and hopefully we can do it. Before we go to break, I want to shout out our number one fan in the Writer's Room universe, Skip Anderson, who had a national champion Hampshire U this week. You can go to Skip's page on Twitter at Baba Acres, B-A-A-B-A-A Acres, and check out his prize-winning sheep. So shout out to Skip. Always appreciate you, buddy. Congratulations. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
Giving back to the community and reinvesting in the industry is of paramount importance to Keeneland.
I think it's important that anybody who participates, buying and selling, that when they participate in Keeneland, they're reinvesting in the industry. That is the mission, that is the goal, that is what the team is dedicated to.
Every single day we come to work and we try to decide what's the right thing to do.
It allows us to build for the future, and the future is bright.
The future is bright at Team November.
Maximum Security proves he's the real deal with a gate-to-wire win in the Florida Derby.
Champion three-year-old.
Maximum Security has won the TVG.com Haskell Invitational.
11 triple-digit buyers.
Maximum Security, he smoked them in the cigar mile.
Grade 1 winning four-year-old.
Maximum Security takes them all the way in the TVG Pacific Classic.
Secure your mare's future. Maximum Security.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Coolmore. Called by Triple Crown winner Justify, top Keeneland second session last week. A weanling named Just Before Dawn was bred by Summerwind Farm and sold for $625,000 to MV Magner. Justify has also been represented as the in-foal sire of several high-profile mares, including Satin and Silk, who brought $1.4 million and was the second highest-priced brood mare of Book 1. Cupid, we keep talking about Cupid. Cupid keeps getting better and better. He had an impressive debut winner earlier this week with Duke of Love at Woodbine from My Racehorse. It seems like we're talking about a new winner for him every week. And the Son of Tappet's 16 winners is now seventh best among all freshman sires. So he's consistently climbing that ladder. And another freshman sire at Ashford, Practical Joke, who we all know has had a really good year, was in the news with Girl with a Dream, who won an allowance impressively at Churchill Downs on Saturday for Brad Cox. Practical Joke now has 17 winners, including five stakes performers. I know John is finalizing some of the matings for 2022 right now and is breed to a couple Coolmore stallions. What about that, John?
Yeah, and you mentioned a couple of them already. I mean, Cupid is one that came back onto our radar screen, primarily because we are doing a lot of racing up in Canada, and he's had a couple of really big winners up there of late. And, when I looked at the stud fees for 2022, I fully expected them to raise his stud fee, quite frankly, but he's at a very, very affordable $5,000 live full stand and nurse. So Cupid is definitely a horse that's in our breeding program and going to be on the, on the radar for 22. You have American Pharoah that we mentioned, we're already breeding to him. Mendelsohn, I think, even though this is kind of the cusp year for stallions because he hasn't had horses of racing age yet, we're big Mendelsohn fans. We're breeding a couple to him, and we own three Mendelsohn two-year-olds, or yearlings that'll be two-year-olds, excuse me. And we are very excited about them. And then I think a horse that's kind of, under the radar, even though he was a great success on the racetrack, is Tis the Law. People aren't really talking about Tis the Law as much as some of the other stallions, but I know Coolmore had an open house this week for their stallions. And a couple of them are still in Australia and haven't been back yet. But of the ones that were on the farm, they're telling me that Tis the Law and Motown were the most popular stallions, the most asked for stallions at their open houses. So to me, that's showing that breeders are looking at those two horses in particular as real value plays for 2022.
Yep. And I'm a big fan of Tis the Law, obviously, and I'm waiting to see what he does. First really good Son of Constitution that's made it to the market. So I think that's going to be interesting. And obviously Motown is Son of Uncle Mo. Those are always going to be popular. Now that we're past the Breeders' Cup, I'm kind of counting down the days. I think we're less than 5 months from Keeneland, April, and we're probably going to see a couple Justifies on the track. That's super exciting. I remember when the American Pharoah started hitting the track. That was exciting. The first Triple Crown winner stallion in forever. Now we're less than 5 months away from seeing some Justifies as well. So that's exciting. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. So we are beyond thrilled to welcome to the show celebrity chef, restaurateur, and a guy whose cat food commercial has the same theme as this show.
Hey everybody, I'm Bobby Flay. You might know me as a chef, but just as importantly, I'm a cat person.
Bobby Flay, thanks for coming on, man.
My pleasure. So good to be here. You learn something new every day. That's an amazing stat.
We're bonded forever now. So obviously the big news is the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies Turf. First of all, congratulations on that win. That's amazing. Obviously I had to throw a few bucks on her just as a hunch bet. It was my only good opinion of the weekend. But what was that like? What was that feeling like? And where does that rank in terms of accomplishments, either in racing or just in your life as a whole?
Well, in racing, it's certainly number one for me. There's no question about it for lots of reasons. I mean, actually, ironically, I won that race 11 years ago in 2010 with More Than Real. And, you know, I would say up until last Friday, that was the biggest race that I had ever won, even though I've won some other races. Actually, interestingly enough, when I won it in 2010, it was actually a grade two, not a grade one. It was a newer race, which, you know, it doesn't really matter, but I've won some other grade ones. I would call it a very large bet on owning, a good, a leg of Creator when he won the Belmont. I literally bought into the horse on the Wednesday before the Saturday of the Belmont. So like, was that exciting? Yeah, of course it was, but I didn't feel like I didn't feel really, vested in it. It was really just making a big bet. And it was fun as can be to be in the winner's circle for the Belmont Stakes as a native New Yorker. Of course, that was amazing, but this was something very, very different. This was, you know, obviously a homebred. Everybody talked about, you know, the fact that I bred the horse, and it's an interesting story of, you know, what can be accomplished in this very, very difficult business that everybody talks about. And I think the number one word that I keep thinking about is patience. I mean, and it's one of the things that if you don't have patience in horse racing in lots of different ways, you're really going to put yourself up against it. And it's really interesting because in general, well, I don't have in the rest of my life, I don't really have a lot of patience. You know, I'm looking for results, you know, rather quickly. But in horse racing, I learned very early on that if the horse tells you that they need time off and you're not patient, it will cost you. And when it comes to breeding, if you're not patient, then you shouldn't be in breeding at all, because it takes a really long time, sometimes never, to accomplish things. And you don't know when it's going to come. And so I bought a horse at Tattersall's in 2014. I bought a horse that I ultimately named White Hot. She was the highest priced filly yearling in the hemisphere, and she never ran. But she had a lights out machine gun, whatever you want to call it, pedigree. You know, she's by Galileo. She was a half to Poimois, who won, you know, the English Derby. And that was just the beginning of the pedigree. It goes on for pages, and it's basically a Coolmore family. If you want to, you know, sort of shorthand it. And the one thing about being able to buy into a family like that is that, Coolmore is such a, those guys are so, they're obviously so focused on making their families better and better that they're going to spend money all over that pedigree, you know, till the end of time. And they're going to actually help you, upgrade your pedigree, because they're going to be investing in it all around it. That said, getting into those families costs a lot of money when they're available. And so I made that bet. Horse never ran. She just wasn't good enough. I mean, that the bottom line was, you know, they can, you know, a yearling sale is such an amazing thing, because we buy and sell these horses at yearling sales for, you know, giant amounts of money, especially if they, as they say, tick all the boxes. They're beautiful. They have a great pedigree. They're right by the right sire, et cetera. And they have a nice walk, which is such a funny thing to think about, because we're in horse racing and they don't walk during the race, but that's as fast as you're going to see them go. And we take a leap of faith, and I took a leap of faith, and it didn't work out, but I knew that I was going to keep this horse for the rest of her life. And that my feeling was, and this is where the patience comes in, was that at some point the blood will show up. If it's that good, something has to happen, either directly or indirectly, that's going to help your family. But you have to be patient. You may have to actually invest more money to continue to breed, but at some point it will work. And I did not obviously expect it to work in the first foal, but it did. And now I would say it's pretty safe to say that the money's off the table, because, you know, that family, the race that she won, I mean, it's all gravy from here on it, here on out. But that obviously doesn't happen all the time. So yes, was it a big day for me? Oh yeah, it was. It was definitely the biggest race that I've ever won.
Hey, Bobby. Bye. Thanks for joining us. A couple other kind of news and notes. We can catch up on the latest. What about next year, 2022 for her? And it would seem off the top of my head, she'd be an awful good candidate for Royal Ascot. What do you think?
Well, Bill, you and I go back a long way. I'm a sportsman. I like to participate, on the big stages. Even if we're up against it. Now, sending a horse to Ascot, I did that. I did that with More Than Real. She ran second to last. We had the best time of our lives. I mean, it's just, that's one of the things about a race like that. You go there, you get dressed up in top hat and tails. You're in the royal enclosure, as they call it. You watch the queen and her family sort of parade around for 4 days. And you get to hang out in London. You get to watch amazing, some of the best horses in the world compete, over the Ascot meet. Yeah. When she crossed the finish line, did I think about Ascot? Completely. And the next day I saw Christophe Clement, who trains the horse. And I said, how do you feel about Ascot? And he said, well, I like Ascot. He said, I actually trained for the queen a long time ago, which I did not know. And so I think it's definitely a possibility. As you know, that is a very hard race. I don't think an American horse has ever won the Coronation Stakes. I looked it up last week, and it didn't seem like, if you go to Wikipedia and you put in Coronation Stakes, it seems like all British trainers or European trainers. I don't remember ever an American horse winning that race, which tells you one thing. It's really hard to do to fly over there and do that. That said, that doesn't mean we wouldn't try it. So basically, Bill, the answer to your question is it's probably either going to be, all things being equal and all things, she's doing well, Ascot. And if not Ascot, she'll point to those three turf races that Naira has created, the turf triple crown for fillies. I think the first one's at Belmont, then it goes to Saratoga, et cetera. And I think back to Belmont. So, we're talking about 5 or 6 months off for sure.
Yeah, Sharing was second last year. I agree with you. I don't think that any American trainers won it, but Sharing was second. So maybe trending in that direction, Americans being a little more competitive.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I'm not afraid to try it. Yeah. If she's telling us that she's doing well, She's also a good candidate there because she likes a cut in the ground. Interestingly enough, I mean, this was the first time we ran her on firm turf, and it was really a question for Christophe. I mean, he was, I have to say, he wasn't gung-ho about going to the Breeders' Cup. He wanted to run in the Chelsea Flower, which is a listed stake, make her a stakes winner, at home in her backyard. And I said, Christophe, I mean, come on, man. Like we have a chance to be, a pretty nicely priced horse when I say nicely priced, meaning like one of the favorites in the Breeders' Cup. Like, we have to do that.
Yeah.
And he said, well, let's see how it goes. And then finally he convinced himself that she was ready to give it a try. And then ultimately when she drew, she was the morning line favorite. Yeah. She didn't wind up being the favorite. She right. She ended up to 9 or 10 to 1, but yeah. So I'm glad we gave it a shot.
For sure. I mean, you mentioned Christophe. That was my next question. Is obviously one of the big stories of that win, in addition to you, was that it was his first Breeders' Cup win. I think everybody who knows him and knows his training career thinks it's long overdue. He's been a great trainer for a long time. I don't remember you having that many horses with him in the past. Can you talk about how that relationship has come about and how it was to share that moment with him getting his first Breeders' Cup win?
I've given him a couple of horses. But to be perfectly frank with you, I hadn't been able to give him anything that was talented enough for him to really show his stuff. And so, I mean, I've always liked Christophe, and I kept three homebreds from Europe last year. And fillies, and I distributed them out. I gave one to Todd, one to Chad, and one to Christophe. Don't ask me why I picked one over the other in terms of which horse who got. I mean, the bottom line is, even like when they're being broken in Florida, and the trainer Paul Sharp broke them all, and he says, this one I think is ahead of this one. I mean, that can change in a week. So I didn't know who to give what to. So I basically just kind of like threw my hands in the air. I was like, okay, I'll give one to Christoph, one to Todd, and one to Chad. I have a Dubawi that I bred, and Chad has the most experience in America with Dubawis. So I just gave him the Dubawi. She hasn't run yet. She'll probably run early part of 22. But, you know, even Christoph said to me, like, you know, before her first race in Saratoga, and I spent a lot of time with him this summer because I bought a house right on the Oklahoma training track. After going there for 40 years, I was tired of staying in those hotels in Saratoga, and I found a house right on the training track. So, you know, I'm sure all the trainers hate it, but I was there every morning because I just love it so much. And so I watched her come along, and I said to him, you know, he said to me, I'm entering her, you know, whatever it was on Thursday for this race. And the race got drawn and somebody said, oh, Chad has a monster in this race. And he looked at me and he said, we'll take her on very calmly. Okay. At that point, I knew that she probably had something, but you don't know until they run. And then she won the first race. And then I said to him, I want to go to the Natalma. And the reason why I wanted to go to the Natalma was because I wanted Lightning to strike again. More Than Real, 11 years ago, won her first race at Saratoga, sent her to the Natalma. She ran second, and then she won the Breeders' Cup. And basically, that's exactly what Pizza Bianca did. Ran second in the Natalma, and it was a very educational race for her. She had to fight through a wall of horses. She got through, and she ran second to a very good horse that Godolphin owns called Wild something. Wild Beauty. And she went back to Europe, didn't come back. And that's okay with me. Nothing to prove. We don't need to be a hero. If she's not there, I was like, clearly as somebody who ran second to her, we were happy that she wasn't coming back because it just makes the competition a little bit lighter. We basically followed the More Than Real, you know, path to the Breeders' Cup.
Bobby, one thing that people may not know a lot about you is in addition to being a horse owner, you're a horse player. And matter of fact, I saw you were in the Breeders' Cup betting challenge this year. Didn't have a whole lot of luck, but also as a fan and also as a former member of the board of directors of the Breeders' Cup, let's talk about the other juvenile turf race, the betting debacle. What's your take on it?
Unfortunate. Just, you know, look, here's the thing. As somebody, I consider myself, you know, part of this community, even though, you know, I don't live it and breathe it every single day like you guys do. But this has been an important sport to me since I was a teenager in lots of different ways. As you said, you know, I grew up, you know, betting horses. And then when I started working for a living, I was able to start investing in buying horses. And then the breeding happened after that. On big days like this, all I do is hold my breath, hoping things just go okay. Because I don't want one more word of bad press for this industry. We don't need it. we only need positive stories. And that said, there could have been a lot worse negativity. I had a huge bet actually in the BCBC. I was in third place up until about an hour and a half before the end. So I was up there. I made a nice bet on Pizza Bianca. She got me, you know, up in the leaderboard. And I made a very, very big bet on Modern Games. And so I was part of that, you know, the sort of the loss of the win, so to speak. But look, it was a human error, obviously. It was a miscommunication or whatever you want to call it. I mean, at some point, I think we have to stop talking about it. There has to be a way. And I don't know enough about the wagering board, Bill. So maybe you can tell me. I know you write about this stuff all the time. What can we do so that when you're in a multi-race bet, you're not given a horse that you don't even want? That's the question. Okay. Cause if the horse runs up the track, there's a lot less conversation about this. Okay. But that didn't happen. And then of course everybody got given that the favorite that ran fifth or something, and everybody got upset. But there has to be something that can be done so that, you know, not everybody thinks that the favorite's the best horse in the race, right? I mean, and I don't know, maybe there's an alternate.
Yeah.
I think the alternate is the way to go. Like I played in a quad. I don't usually do this, but about 3 weeks ago, I played in one of horse players qualifying tournaments. And you have to, you know, and it was just win in place. And you have to pick a horse, and then you have to pick an alternate just in case something like that happens. I think that that has to be the way to go. There has to, they have to be able to have the technology to do that. Don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. And the whole thing about, I think the problem that most people had was that the horse was able to be scratched, reinserted into the pools, and then was taken out again. I think that's the big problem.
I think at that point, once there's an official announcement, it's over. That's what I would say.
Yeah, I guess, but the owner and the trainer get a second chance to run, you know? So I think bettors usually feel like they get the shaft on these kind of things.
That's my point.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask this question. You talked about how racing has too many negative stories. I want to ask about how people in your world what's their general feeling about racing? I usually ask this to people who are successful in high profile industries, usually sports, what their experience is in trying to maybe recruit people into the game or bring people to the track. What's your general, what's the general reaction you get when you try to bring people in your world into racing?
There's only one way to do it. You have to expose them to it. When somebody asks me for a recipe and I give them a recipe, if I hand you a sheet of paper or I tell you to go download something off a website and you make it, it's going to be one way. But if I actually show you how to do it, it's going to come out differently and probably better because I'm showing you as opposed to telling you. I think it's the same thing for exposing people to horse racing. If I tell people about my experience, they're like, oh yeah, that's great. You know, a lot of people don't even know what the Breeders' Cup is, unfortunately. You know, they know the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, they know the Triple Crown races, you know, unless they, you know, if they don't really follow horse racing at all. And what I do is I take people to the races. I take them to big races because I want them to see big events. I want them to see racing at its best. I want them to see the best horses and the biggest crowds. I want them to feel like they're going to an event. When I do that, they're hooked. They're like, I can't believe I've never done this before. And I hear that all the time. And you think to yourself, well, clearly we could do something better to get people to go racing. But, you know, basically, you know, there's a couple of things going on here. Number one, when I was a kid, the racetracks were packed like Yankee Stadium was packed. There were, you know, you could go basically, you know, at any day of the week and there was a huge crowd there. And on the weekends, it was always a mob scene. You know, we've obviously moved away from that with technology. So you can bet at home in the comfort of your home, et cetera, et cetera. And there's a lot to be said about that because it's easy to do. And, you know, and as long as people are betting, that's a really good thing. But there's only a few opportunities a year to take people and expose them to what we already know is an amazing sport. And the Breeders' Cup obviously is one of them. And of course the Triple Crown races, even some of the big racing days on, you know, at NYRA, like in the fall or in the spring, you know, where we have like lots of races clustered together, we still don't get big crowds. So it's just a handful of races a year. And when I do that, I mean, every year I take about 25 or 30 people to the Belmont Stakes, half of them never been to a race before, they become race fans.
Yep.
Bobby, you're obviously someone who's been very creative in your career, a good marketer, a good person at getting results from a business. Sort of a general question. And again, going back to your time on the Breeders' Cup board, it's a great event. Even with the mess up in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile, it was a really good year for the Breeders' Cup. You have any thoughts on, can it be made any better? What can be done to take this event and make it even better now?
Bill, you're asking me questions, and this is the reason why I'm not on the board anymore.
Right. Okay.
You know, I spent a lot of time on the Breeders' Cup Board of Directors and NYRA, and I really enjoyed my time doing that. I wanted to participate in trying to do whatever I could do to make the sport or the event better. You know, I created, you know, the Breakfast Marquee, which has become like this, you know, really fantastic thing to go to in the morning at Breeders' Cup. So people can, you know, socialize and see the horses and et cetera, and get some good food in the morning. The other thing I did at Breeders' Cup was created the Taste of the World. They didn't have it this year, probably because of COVID, et cetera. I think that there could be I was always pushing for a very controversial race, which was called the Breeders' Cup Derby. And it got a lot of, like, you know, attention in the horse racing media about, is it a good thing? Is it a bad thing? Ultimately, it didn't go anywhere. But the only thing that I wanted to do in that case was, you know, unfortunately, the older horses don't get as much play as the three-year-olds. And it's for one reason. It's because we are, you know, we have these relationships with NBC, who spend millions and millions of dollars all year long. And Fox does it as well. And they support the three-year-old races, the Derby prep, all the Derby preps, the Derby itself, the Preakness, all the, you know, the Belmont Stakes, the Triple Crown, the Haskell, the Travers. They spent a fortune promoting all these three-year-olds. And then all of a sudden the Breeders' Cup comes and it's done, and they get pushed in with the older horses. So basically, people who are traditionalists are like, well, that's the way horse racing is. Three-year-olds catch up to the older horses by November, and they should compete against each other. The bottom line is, we don't know that to be true. I mean, yes, every once in a while, does a three-year-old beat them? Yes. But for the most part, I mean, look at this year. I mean, Essential Quality, you know, was one of the better three-year-olds we've had in a long time. I mean, he was so incredibly consistent around the far turn. You know, now you can say it was conditioning. Who knows what happened? But around the far turn, the older horses just spurted away. Now, there can be tons of arguments, but what I'm saying is, from a marketing standpoint, that was the question you asked. From a marketing standpoint, why lose the three-year-old competition? You know, all of a sudden in November in the Breeders' Cup, in the World Championships of horse racing, when we've been supporting them from a marketing standpoint, and the people outside of horse racing actually know those horses' names this year. That's all I'm saying. That's all I wanted to do. And of course it became sort of a political conversation, and ultimately it didn't happen. That's fine. But, you know, so that was my only sort of marketing insight, because, you know, marketing is something I pay a lot of attention to. And we have great resources. The fact that we have a network like NBC, who puts their heart and soul into these broadcasts. I mean, they're beautiful. I just did something with them the other day. I don't know if you got to see the telecast, the classic telecast, the 1 hour telecast. I was the opening. It was a scripted opening. They did it in my kitchen outside. It was about the surf meets the turf. And we used, you know, lobster and steak cooking to kind of emulate that for Del Mar. It was a work of art. They did beautiful work to really kind of announce the Breeders' Cup Classic. It was beautiful.
Yeah, no, they do a great job. That's all I have for you, except for one more question. You name the horse Pizza Bianca. You got to have a Pizza Bianca recipe, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. For sure.
Can you share that with us?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, and what I'm actually making one of the appetizers I'm making for Thanksgiving is a Pizza Bianca. I have to do it because, you know, it's been a great year for Pizza Bianca in my life. So what I do is I make pizza dough, and then I dock it, meaning I take a fork and I dot the pizza dough. It's just the dough itself with a little bit of olive oil on top. And I dock it all over on top of it. And then I put it in the pizza oven and I cook it about 3/4 of the way. So it kind of gets a little puffy, gets crusty on both sides. And then I take it out and I take a serrated knife and I slice in the middle of it. So you basically open it up. So it's like a sandwich. And I take a cheese called Robiola cheese, which is a very spreadable Italian, almost cream cheese-like, cheese, and I spread that on there, and I put some white truffle in there. I close it back up, put it back in the oven for like 30 seconds so it gets nice and crispy. Take it out, a little garlic and fresh oregano oil on top, and it's like a little appetizer. It's like a, you know, while you're eating your pumpkin soup or whatever you're having, you know, as an appetizer for Thanksgiving. So it's crispy, it's creamy in the middle, and it's Pizza Bianca.
That's amazing. I hope all the listeners were taking notes on all that. Perfect.
I'll put it on my website.
Thank you so much for coming on. Congrats.
Thanks,
on the
Bobby.
Continued success. Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure. I love watching you guys. You guys do a really fantastic job. And, it's always so insightful, and I learn a lot watching and listening to you guys. So thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Bobby. Thank you.
That means a lot. Thanks, Bobby. Yeah.
All right, guys. See ya.
Cheers, man. Thanks. The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group Guest of the Week, Bobby Flay, will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
Why do the most successful owners, breeders, and horsemen select the Green Group as their tax advisor? We simply save them money and know how to make them more successful. Over the past 40 years, founder Leonard Green has owned and bred some of the best racehorses in the history of the sport. His in-depth, hands-on industry knowledge, combined with cutting-edge tax-saving strategies, has produced positive results for his clientele and has made the Green Group the top-rated accounting and tax firm in the business. For a confidential and complimentary consultation, contact us at 732-634-5100 or visit our website at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
Connect, the next in line to carry on Lane's End's tried and true stallion tradition. A grade one winning millionaire son of Curlin. Physically impressive and dominant on the track. Winner of the grade one Cigar Mile and the grade two Pennsylvania Derby, where he defeated Gunrunner, Nyquist, and Exaggerator. With multiple six-figure yearlings in his first crop, up to $360,000. Connect, a proven winner on the track, a proven stallion in the making.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by the Lane's End Farm. Lane's End Stallion of the Week this week is Lexingtonian. It was announced over the weekend at Lexingtonian, which is the center of Spikestown, and homebred for Calumet Farm out of a Tappet mare. Will stand the 2022 breeding season at Lane's End for $10,000. The Jack Sisterson trainee won the Grade 3 Chick Lang last year as a sophomore. Was beating a nose in the Bing Crosby, and this year he beat the likes of Special Reserve Whitmore and Forense Fire and the Alfred G. Vanderbilt, which, as we know, is a Grade 1 sprint at Saratoga. One thing I remember about Lexingtonian was last year when he was in the Vanderbilt, he got scratched at the gate, and Jack Sisterson said, screw it, I'm going to ship him across country to run the Bing Crosby 7 days later. He comes flying late and just misses by a nose. I think that spoke to the confidence that Jack Sisterson had in Lexingtonian. I thought it was super impressive to go from being scratched at the gate to 7 days later across the country, missing by a nose in a grade one. He was always a very likable, admirable horse. Obviously, great family. John, you have any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, anytime you start with a sire line of Spikestown and finish with out of a Tappet mare, you know, that's hot, you know, rare air as far as breeding goes. Add to that, Joe, the fact that this horse, Lexingtonian, is inbred to Mr. Prospector, Secretariat, Bold Ruler, Buck Passer, and Northern Dancer. You know, five just, you know, superstar stallions in the past generations. And the fact that they're doubling up on those great genetics is huge for a new stallion, you know, an opportunity. And the fact that he's a son of Spikestown, you know, we talk about Spikestown being a great sire, but how about the fact that now he's considered a sire of sires with Central Banker dominating New York? You have Charlatan, who, you know, basically you can't get to if you wanted to breed him to him at $50,000 this year. Echo Town at Coolmore. Munnings, who, you know, they raised the stud fee not only from $40,000 to higher, but they doubled his stud fee from $40,000 to $85,000. So Munnings is, another great son of Spikestown. And then Spikester, who stands at Windstar for $7,500. So there is history involved in Lexingtonian, not only in the fact that he comes from such great stock, but also that a lot of the sons of Spikestown have proven themselves worthy of standing in Kentucky and succeeding in Kentucky.
Yeah, huge fan of Spikestown over here. And he's getting up there in age too, so I don't think you're going to have that many more new opportunities to breed to his sons. So Lexingtonian definitely makes sense for breeders at Lane's End. $10,000 to start, grade one winner, should be popular. So this is going to be an ongoing subplot. And I know everyone's sick of Bob Baffert, and had enough talking about Bob Baffert this year. No one's more sick of it than me. But, you know, the more good two-year-olds he has, the more it's going to be, you know, the story's going to be knocking at the door that what's going to happen with these horses going forward, because the prep races are starting. The points races for the Derby are starting. They're going to be a couple in November, I believe. Churchill Downs is going to be the Remsen at Aqueduct. And, you know, once the new year starts, we're going to be in full swing for Derby prep season. So this is going to be a decision that's going to have to be made for a lot of people, for a lot of owners. in the next month or two what they're going to do with these two-year-olds that are with the Bob Baffert barn right now. And I'm bringing it up because there was another one over the weekend, Messier, who won the Bob Hope Stakes at Del Mar on Sunday. It's Baffert's 11th win in the Bob Hope. There were four horses in the race. He had three of them, so he was most likely going to win that race. Honestly, wasn't that impressed with him. It was a super, super sonic pace. He kind of just loped away from the field late, but that's the kind of race that, you know, if you're seven or eight lengths off of a 43 2/2, you're still running pretty fast. So it's not as if he's going to finish with, you know, this huge flourish. Nevertheless, it was mentioned over the weekend in relation to Corniche. Dan Liebman had an op-ed in the TDN talking about how the Corniche connections should consider the Dennis Diaz route. Now, in 1985, Dennis Diaz owned Spend a Buck, who won the Derby, but the people who run Jersey Racing had put up this huge bonus if you won the Derby and then the Jersey Derby plus the two preps at Monmouth that year. So it was a $2 million bonus. He decided to do that instead of running the Preakness. The horse won all of those races, made a lot more money than he would just running in the Preakness, which I think was like $350,000 purse that year. So Dan was saying that, you know, if the owners really want to be loyal to Bob Baffert, the Garden State, thanks, Bill. It was a Garden State, not Monmouth. But if owners really want to be loyal to Bob Baffert here and want to kind of upend this process, you know, I'm sure somebody out there, some other track out there can put up a bonus to try to lure people away from the Derby. It's a nice idea, but at the end of the day, the Derby is the Derby. The Kentucky Derby is the race that everybody, as soon as a foal hits the ground, everybody starts thinking and dreaming about the Kentucky Derby. And especially for Corniche's connections, Peter Floor and Casey Weiner from Speedway, they never even sniffed the Derby. They had Roadster a couple of years ago, didn't really do any running. Then he got hurt. I think for guys who've spent a ton of money in this game, Corniche was a $1.5 million auction purchase. I just think it's unrealistic to think guys like that are not going to do everything in their power to win the Kentucky Derby, because otherwise, what is it all for? What are you spending all this money for if it's not to end up wearing the roses? What do you guys think?
Yeah, I mean, I thought Dan's column was, was interesting, but it wasn't practical, is the way that I would put it. And by the way, just so, apropos of nothing, Messier is not, the partnership includes nine owners.
Owners. I was going to say, I think the three of us are the only people in the industry.
Anyways,
we're the super Avengers now. Avengers, not just the regular Avengers.
I mean, going back to Spend a Buck, Dennis Diaz, the owner, he did what he did because it gave him the opportunity to make the most money. So he didn't do anything out of, you know, spite to the Derby or goodness of his heart. He went for the money. And that's what you can expect everybody to do. I mean, not only do you want to win the Derby for all the prestige and the dream and that sort of thing, but, you know, that race more than any other adds on to the horse's stud value, et cetera. And if you think about it, if you were to pass the Derby, presumably by next year, Baffert won't be allowed to run in the Belmont either. So that's quite possible. So you're going to gear up your whole campaign, early campaign, March, April, et cetera, just to win the Preakness? Nobody's going to do that. So, I mean, I think these owners, there's no reason for them to jump ship now. They can wait to the very last minute, and maybe Baffert will win something in court. They'll get him the clear and free to run in the Kentucky Derby. I think they might even be able to wait to that last series of prep races, or maybe the penultimate one, like the San Felipe and the Fountain of Youth and ones like that. But nobody's going to pass. Nobody's going to say, boy, I'm on your side, Bob. This is terrible what they're doing. I'm sticking with you. I'm passing the Derby. It ain't happening.
No, and I enjoy Dan's articles. And I've always been a fan of his. But when I read this op-ed piece, my head was ready to explode. I couldn't understand, couldn't get my mind around what he was talking about. And he does answer some questions. Number one is that obviously marijuana use is legal in Kentucky, because that's the only way that he could come up with this stretch of an idea that Spend a Buck is like Corniche, you know, Spend a Buck's situation is like Corniche's situation. You know, we've been in the business for a long time, obviously. Whenever anybody, you know, knows that we own horses, the very first question is, do you know Bill Finley? And then after that, the next question is, have you ever run in the Derby? And when they say the Derby, they don't mean the Jersey Derby. They don't mean the Iowa Derby or the Indiana Derby. No offense to those state derbies. They mean the Kentucky Derby, because the entire industry, our entire industry, is predicated on those 2 minutes of racing. Tens and hundreds of millions of dollars are spent every year to try to get horses in the Kentucky Derby. That's why out of all the major races that we run in this country, it is the only one that always overfills. You know, we talk about the Breeders' Cup Classic, and this year there were 8 or 9 horses in that race. There were 6 horses and 5 horses in a couple of the other Breeders' Cup races. The Saudi Cup, which is the richest, you know, person in the world, doesn't overfill. The Kentucky Derby every year overfills. Why is that? Because everyone focuses on that one race. And when Dan was talking about, well, spend a buck, you know, should skip a race, they skip the Preakness. And again, no offense to the Preakness, but I'd be hard pressed to remember, and Bill, you could probably answer this better than I could, when the last time the Preakness overfilled. And that's like the second jewel in the Triple Crown. That's the second, arguably the second most important 3-year-old race in the country. And that's the race that they skipped. They didn't skip the Kentucky Derby. They skipped the Preakness. Spend a Buck, you know, again, no offense to Spend a Buck, was the son of Buckaroo. Nobody's going to confuse Buckaroo with Quality Road, who's the sire of Corniche. Spend a Buck wasn't sold at auction. Corniche was a $1.5 million colt that sold as a 2-year-old. And the reason being is because he was so damn good looking, but also because he's a stallion prospect. You don't skip the Kentucky Derby, the most important race on a resume for a 3-year-old, to show loyalty for a guy that they've been racing with for 5 years. And Speedway Stable has been in existence for 6 years. And you know how many trainers they have? They've used 5 trainers in those 6 years. So they don't have loyalty to Bob Baffert like Jill Baffert would, or even Mike Pegram would. Maybe the Avengers would, but I have a sneaky suspicion that even if the Avengers were in this situation, they would kick them to the curb so they could win, you know, get the last dollar on the table also. So Dan, I loved your piece. I thought it was entertaining. Is it practical? Is it realistic? Is it even, you know, on point with what's going on here? Not even close, but I love the article.
Yeah, it's a good jumping off point for discussion. Yeah, I mean, the only way this would make sense, I kind of got the feeling that this might have been ghostwritten by Bob Baffert. It's like Bob Baffert with a mustache. It's like, no, this isn't Bob Baffert. This is Bob Trefab.
Like when Bobby Valentine went back after he got thrown out of the game and he went back into the right. dugout with the fake mustache. Yeah.
Like, will someone listen to the wisdom of Dennis Diaz from 1985? Bob Baffert deserves a second chance.
Who said that? That makes sense. Yeah.
I also like how Joe ripped the column, just ripped it and ended with like, but I love you, Dan. That was a great column. You know,
I said the same thing you guys did. It was unrealistic. I didn't say it was a bad column.
No. I said, I'm sorry. Not Joe. I mean, John.
I said that. John. I was only saying that to be nice. I really thought I read it twice, because the first time my head almost exploded. And the second time I was like, wait, did I miss something? Like, was this in The Onion as opposed to in the Thoroughbred Daily News? Because it didn't make any sense to me whatsoever. And Dan even says he's a Kentuckian. He understands the importance of the Kentucky Derby, but this has no merit at all. He did say one thing in the article, kidding aside, that is 1,000% true. And that is that it's the only 2 options that these guys have is of Speedway owners I'm talking about, is either to transfer the colt, you know, sooner rather than later to another trainer, to allow the horse to be eligible to run in these at Churchill and at the Belmont, or they're going to do what everybody else does, which is, you know, go to court. Yeah, go to court and try to get it, you know, try to get it overturned, or at least, you know, suspend it so they can run in the Kentucky Derby. And you know what, guys? Unfortunately, if any of these horses, you know, whether it's Corniche or something else that's, you know, under the charge of Bob Baffert, if any of those horses continue to climb and climb and become the prohibitive favorite, you know, for the Kentucky Derby, that may add a little merit to the strength of their argument. From a legal standpoint, it doesn't, but from a sentimentality point, it does.
But I'm sorry, you got to remember, Baffert has taken no, and his team have taken no legal action. They doesn't even look like they're trying. And against Churchill Downs, they you know, went to all these lengths to get Naira to overturn their ban. And I can only guess it because they know they can't win.
Yeah, I mean, they found a loophole in the Naira thing, basically. They found a legal loophole that they were denied due process, mm-hmm. because Naira is a quasi-state agency, and that's not the case with the Kentucky. Yeah, I was reading that line too, and maybe that was ghostwritten by Craig Robertson, John. This is definitely not Craig Robertson saying you should sue him.
Bob Baffert, do more sue. Don't look at the man behind the curtain.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by XBTV. I've gone on and on about XBTV and how well they gather and produce all the workouts. The workout of the week this week is Triple Tap. Was working in company on Monday, going 4 furlongs and 49-1. He's a half brother to American Pharaoh. He's undefeated. He won earlier this year and came back on one of the Breeders' Cup undercards and won again. And is now 2 for 2. Looks to have an exciting future. Obviously, great family as well. He's a homebred for Summerwind Equine late in his 3-year-old year. Hopefully see him a lot more in his 4-year-old year as well. But you can keep tabs on him and all the other big horses who are working towards their 4-year-old campaigns on XBTV. They're probably showing the work right now. Very good looking horse. Yeah, love that chestnut, that glowing chestnut frame of his. Definitely one we'll be looking out for, and keep tabs on him on XBTV. We'll be right back after this message from XBTV.
All the thrills, fraction of the bills, experience the power of the partnership, change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by West Point Thoroughbreds. Joining a West Point Thoroughbreds partnership can vault you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. West Point had an exciting day at Del Mar last Friday. 2-year-old filly Unbridled Mary, broker maiden on debut. She's trained by John Sadler, owned in partnership with Pearl Racing and Mark Pine. They also had County Final. Trained by Steve Asmussen, won a $160,000 allowance race at Churchill on Thursday. Those purses are just mind-blowing, those allowance purses. Like, there's, I feel like 80% of stakes in this country don't have the purses that the Churchill allowance have right now. So that was nice from County Final, because he's the kind of horse that, you know, he's obviously been good on the turf. Hadn't quite done the same on dirt since winning the off-the-turf Tyro Stakes. Got back on dirt, had a really nice win. So it's obviously valuable to have the kind of horse who can run on multiple services. So congratulations to the partners there. And earlier last week, they saw their fan favorite filly, Hard Not to Love, who was in our copy for a while. We love Hard Not to Love. She's a very admirable horse. One eye, I believe, right? She's got one eye as well. She sold for $3.2 million at the Facing November sale. Obviously very well received. She was purchased as a yearling for $400,000. She lost one eye in a paddock accident as a 2-year-old. Thank you, Katie, for confirming that for me. And she went on to win the La Brea Stakes, the Grade 1 La Brea and the Grade 2 Santa Monica for owners and trainer John Sheriff. She was a very, very nice horse and obviously a great investment as well. $400,000 yearling. Made a bunch of money on the track. Sells for 3.2 at Facing November. So huge congratulations to all the partners at West Point on her career, her selling at Facing as well. Bill Finley wrote about this, and the news in this case is really that there was no news, and it's that we ran a Lasix-free Breeders' Cup, and basically nothing happened. No one really said anything about it, but I'll let Bill expound on it.
Well, Joe, that's the headline, definitely, that nothing happened. And I bet you, if to the two of you and people listening, if you think back, did you even like think about it? Did it ever even cross your mind? I don't think it really did to anybody. And yeah, that is the story, because you know, as the sport finally is weaning itself off of Lasix and doing it sort of in piecemeal, you know, again, horsemen's groups, et cetera. I mean, there's this just outcry of how this is the most horrible thing that's ever going to happen, and horses are going to bleed in all over the racetrack, and you know it's going to throw the form into disarray, and you know horses are going to, it's cruel to horses. And you look at this Breeders' Cup, and you know, again, I did. If you stick the thing down their throats, obviously you're going to find some sort of bleeding. But did anybody, did any single horse have any sort of serious bleeding problem? I don't know for a fact they didn't, but you sure didn't hear about it. And you think you would have. I also checked in with the equine medical director of the California Horse Racing Board, Dr. Jeff Blay, and he said the exact same thing. So, you know, I think, you know, and everybody, sometimes when I bring this up or people talk about Lasix, as you know, why waste time with Lasix? There's so much more serious issues in this game. And I understand that. I get that. But that doesn't mean that when it comes to this issue, you shouldn't do the right thing. And I've always thought, I mean, going back to when Lasix was approved in New York back in the 1990s to become they were the last track standing that didn't have Lasix, that, you know, the sport would be better off without it. And then everybody saying, no, you can't, and given all these excuses why you can't. This Breeders' Cup proved that, you know, frankly, it's not really a big deal. You can get rid of Lasix. The horses will run just fine. There's not going to be 999 times out of 1,000. There's not going to be any kind of incidents. So, you know, if you can run a Breeders' Cup like this, no problem. You know, why then do you have Lasix? And it's going to be under HISA. It's going to be phased out in a couple of years. And again, I think there's going to be a big hue and cry about how, you know, this is so necessary for these horses. And I'm, you know what? I'm just not buying it. I haven't for the longest time. And I think that the Breeders' Cup, you know, bears that out.
Well, the only thing that I'll jump in on with regard to Lasix, and it didn't happen personally for any of our horses, but I know for some clients and trainers who were clients of ours, they had to do for the older horses that they had, the top older horses, they had to do a lot of pre-planning with regard to, is this state going to allow me to run on my horse on Lasix who's run on it for 2, 3, 4 years? Or do I have to try something else to try to get them to stop bleeding? And I really genuinely believe that one of the reasons why there were a couple of races that had a smaller amount of horses. I know one of them was a two-year-old race, but there were a couple others that were for older horses. People didn't have a lot of options shipping out to California with Tex Sutton losing their plane. So there was limited pallets available to fly out to California, and some people just opted not to do it. And the other is because there were some older horses that do perform better on Lasix, and they knew that they weren't going to be allowed to use it out in California. They opted not to run them.
I got to jump in here because that's ludicrous. These horses were running.
It's not ludicrous. Actually, I spoke to trainers who are clients of ours who actually gave me horses that we're not sending to California, Bill. So,
all right.
Ludicrous, but okay, anyway, is it anecdotal? Is it a small number?
Yeah, it's a small number. I'll use a more polite term. I disagree. You overlooked a major factor here. These horses weren't running on Lasix all year long. There were only five horses in the entire Breeders' Cup, and I counted up, that ran on Lasix in the previous starts. So if they're okay not to run on Lasix in the Whitney, the Met Mile, the Bluegrass, the Kentucky Derby, Phillies and whatnot, the Kentucky Oaks, why wouldn't they be able to run without Lasix in the Breeders' Cup? There was no Lasix allowed in the vast majority of American graded stakes races run in this country. So, you know, the Breeders' Cup horses, and no one could use Lasix in any two-year-old races. So all the Breeders' Cup horses, not all, but 95% of them had Lasix for a year. So why would it be any different in the Breeders' Cup?
Okay, so trainers who had horses in Canada that were allowed to use Lasix, or trainers who were using Lasix in other jurisdictions, albeit maybe it wasn't for graded stake races, but they still had the opportunity to run on Lasix. If they didn't have the opportunity to run on Lasix and they knew that they were going to put up a lot of money and have their horse not perform well, then they opted not to go to California. Now, is it a small minority? Probably, but there were people who made that decision. And even on our pre Breeders' Cup show, I remember we talked about a couple of trainers and Danny Gargan being one of them, where I said the horse ran much better on Lasix in New Jersey than he did when he ran off of Lasix in the previous start. So there were options where horses did run on Lasix and ran, because I don't think it's a performance enhancing drug at all. I think that in essence, it allows a horse to run to its ability. But if trainers knew that they weren't going to be able to use it in California in the Breeders' Cup, then they weren't opting to do it. I know we're kind of going off path, because the bottom line of your story is it was much ado about nothing. And I agree with that. The horses that ran in California, it was much ado about nothing. Thankfully, there was no bleeding. There was no optics of a horse finishing and gushing blood, or the groom having, you know, blood all over his shoulder and or shirt because the horse was outwardly hemorrhaging blood. I'm glad that that was the case. But I can't honestly say, just again, anecdotally, I can't honestly say that there weren't people who opted not to run out there. But the horses that did run in California and abided by the no Lasix rules, there was no issue. You were 1,000% correct on that.
All right, I'll just put, you're just wrong. That's all.
Well, we're going to agree to disagree. Okay. I'll give you the afterwards. I'll give you the numbers of the trainers. You can talk to them yourself if you'd like.
Well, that was unexpected. I always love a little Bill and John beef. I didn't want to step in there. I mean, I don't have much to add to that. I agree with John. Like my inclination, and I'm not, you know, a medical expert on these kind of things, but just from, you know, watching racing and watching the way horses run on it and don't run on it, it seems to me more like a performance enabling drug than a performance enhancing drug. I think it allows some horses who are bleeders to be able to run their top race. And I never understood why it was such a big deal for racing to get rid of Lasix. And that, you know, Bill, I think, is nodding at me that I've always said, like, why are we wasting so much time talking about Lasix when there are so many other bigger, more impactful drug issues going on in the sport? And also, the thing I'll say is that, you know, horses bleeding, it kind of happens a little bit out of vision. You know, it's not like a horse, when a horse breaks down and everybody can see it and the entire world is watching that horse, in agony or in pain and injured. Lasix happens a little bit more like on the, you know, it's a more of an analytical thing. Like on the way back to the barn, they scope the horse. Like it's kind of the sort of thing that people don't see, you know, out in front of them. So I think it might be happening like a little bit more than people realize that horses are bleeding with not being able to run on Lasix in stakes races and 2-year-old races and the Breeders' Cup. So it's great that in this instance, it was not an issue and it was not, you know, a visible impediment to horses running their good races. And Bill might be right that, you know, this thing will just get phased out eventually entirely. And, you know, the horses will eventually adapt and their biological systems will adapt and it'll be kind of bred out of the thoroughbred over time that horses need Lasix. But, you know, I think there are more horses struggling with it than maybe just saying, well, no horses outwardly bred in the Breeders' Cups, therefore it's not an issue for anybody. I think it might be a little bit more complex than that. But I am with Bill in that I'm sick of talking about it. I'm sick of the about Lasix. Let that John Bill beef be the last argument on Lasix we ever have on this show.
I concur. We have a lot of other beefs to go over.
Yep. Let's get into it. What else you guys want to talk about?
Just how bad the Red Sox are.
Oh, jeez.
We've done that a lot.
Oh, all right. So no more baseball. We'll get rid of the no more baseball, no more Baffert, no more Lasix. Is that the our mantra for 2022?
Nothing left in the shelves.
Yeah, we will make it 1 week.
We talked about this last week, obviously, on the show with the juvenile turf debacle and all the nonsense that happened before that race with bettors getting screwed over. Pat Cummings is always a very, you know, illuminating voice on these kind of things. He did a post for the Thoroughbred Idea Foundation earlier this week talking about potential fixes for this kind of thing and like how bad it is to disregard bettors in that way. Talked a lot about the purse money only rule. From his piece, I think there were two main takeaways in terms of what can be done to fix that kind of situation. One, he was talking about globally commingled pools so that it's not, you know, Mo, Larry, and Curly running the Mutuel's facet of the Breeders' Cup at Del Mar. So I think, you know, more oversight might help in that way. But the other thing he was talking about is, you know, the idea of scratching everybody when that happens and basically making it a non-wagering event when there's a late scratch and there's confusion about whether or not the horse can run or is going to run for purse money only. I don't know about that. I think I think it makes sense conceptually, but I think in practice, you're going to have a lot more pissed off people instead of just a segment of pissed off people who bet on modern games. I think to me, it's just mainly the purse money only rule needs to go away. and except in extreme circumstances, like we were talking about last week, where like a horse throws a shoe in the paddock, or there's some kind of physical issue that was not disclosed to the public. It's the only way it makes sense to me. Those scratches of the late parts of the entry, do away with the entry rule while we're at it. Like, I don't care anymore about the same ownership and the same trainer. Like, if they're fixing races, we got a lot, we got a lot more easy ways to figure out people are fixing races than them having two horses in the same race by the same owner and the same trainer who aren't coupled. Like, I think we've gotten past the point where we need that to figure out if people are fixing races. And the problem with the purse money only thing, it was something that Pat brought up too, is the one of the big issues is that the horse affects the race. It's not just that the horse wins without people's money on it, which is enough of a disaster itself, but minor games could affect other people in the race. Could go to the front, could burn up somebody on the lead, could drift wide off the turn and eliminate three or four horses, could make somebody check and take back if he starts retreating on the rail. That to me is a big issue as well. And I was thinking, it's like, if in basketball you had, like, at the Laker game before the game, like, LeBron James today will be playing for his salary only. None of the points that he scores will count towards the final total. Like, that would be extremely bizarre to see LeBron running around blocking people and scoring baskets, and it doesn't actually affect the score of the game. That's essentially what you have when you have somebody running for purse money only. I think that's the main thing, is that that rule needs to go away, except in extreme, extraordinary circumstances. I think the purse money only rule has outlived its usefulness. I wonder what Bill thinks.
Well, here's what I think. There was no solution to this. I mean, once the horse was scratched mistakenly by the first bet, there's not a single solution that would have kept everybody happy. So that once that mistake was made, forget about it. So you just can't make that mistake, and which we've gone over a number of times. And Modern Games, by the way, who ran just fine without Lasix in the Breeders' Cup juvenile turf. But I thought Pat's, of all the solutions that have been proposed, I thought Pat's that just make the entire race a non-betting race was probably the best one I've heard. But I know that the Breeders' Cup has to protect the bettors, but I mean, how many millions of dollars would they have lost if they did that? So, everybody's trying to find a magic bullet to this. There is none. It was very unfortunate. They screwed up. And, hopefully they'll get it, do a better job next time.
Well, and guys, I'm not a big gambler, okay? But isn't part of gambling, like, that you're taking the risk that the horse, the horse that you pick is going to win? But there are a lot of hurdles that are in the way of that horse winning, one of which is successfully getting into the gate and successfully leaving the gate. I mean, Joe, how many times have you bet on a horse that you thought was definitely going to win and it just gets left at the gate for whatever reason? The jockey fell asleep, the horse, the ground broke out from under it, it got banged by two other horses and ends up, front runner ends up being last. You can't say, well, I want to disqualify, my bet and get a refund because it wasn't fair. That's what happens. I mean, you run the risk that you're betting on that horse. And if the horse doesn't make it into the gate or make it out of the gate or run the way you want, that's your wager. That's what you're betting. So that needs to be kind of baked into it. But the other points that you guys are saying, as far as, like, there's no solution. You can't, the best case scenario is that the horse scratches and you get the wagering favorite at the time. Well, everybody knows that if you're a real handicapper, you might not want the favorite. You might not want that horse because it's one of four front runners that has to have the lead. And you're cagey enough and smart enough to see that the pace isn't going to do it. You might not want the favorite because, some computer picked a well-bred first-time starter as the favorite. And you know that there's a horse that ran once that had an excuse that you wanted to bet on. So there's a whole myriad of reasons, why you can't, why the automatic favorite, doesn't necessarily work either. But maybe it's the best of a bunch of bad options. But at the end of the day, you're betting. I mean, if I buy stock and then find out the next day that the CEO gets caught, for some kind of scandal, I can't say, well, wait a second, I didn't know that was going to happen, so I want, my money back. You made a bet, in essence. You got to stick with it.
Hold on. That's different than the horse not being afforded a fair start at the race. Like, you're talking about a horse that breaks last or whatever. Yeah, once the gate opens, you're on your own. But if the gate opens and the starter is holding the horse, you get your money back. And that's how it should be. It's not as if you place a bet and then everything that happens after that you should be on the hook for. Once the gate opens and the horse gets out without being impeded, you know, by one of the starters or something, I agree. Whatever happens after that, you're on your own. But overall, there's a lot of things that can be put in to protect the bettor up until that point. And I think that that's what the purse money only rule was intended to do in the first place. But it's become kind of more of a nuisance, I think, than something that protects the bettors. So, yeah, I mean, yeah, if the gates open and, you know, Modern Games, you know, runs out and, you know, chops off the seven horses at the start, then you got a whole nother problem, because Modern Games was in the race. And if he, you know, either way, he's affecting the race when you had no chance to either bet on him or bet against him. So that becomes a big problem, right, as well.
That's a bigger problem. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's what the purse money only rule, you know, that's the possibility of the purse money only rule and, you know, possibly the negative ramifications of that. So I just got to stick it for the bettors, John, because that's a different thing.
Oh, yeah. I agree. And the bettors are often the ones that get swept, you know, aside when it comes to these decisions. And we said that last time. We said that, yeah, you know, when we talked about this race, that, and I'm not anti-bettor, don't get me wrong. I mean, I truly honestly believe and know that their money is what fuels the purses and fuels, you know, the, yeah, engine that makes the industry go. I'm, you know, pro bettors as far as that goes. My bet is buying the horse, not betting, okay, on the horse. But I'm still, oh, yeah, in essence, you know, putting my money up. But no, there needs to be some kind of protection. But to Bill's point, I don't know what that is. I don't know what the right answer is.
Yeah, well, and I think that was kind of Pat's point about having the globally commingled pools run by the Hong Kong Jockey Club, or like that you at least have some kind of set protocol for these things. Whereas in racing, in American racing, at least, so many times it seems like they're making it up as they go along. And that definitely seemed like the case at Del Mar, where they were the scratch and then the reinsertion and the other scratch. I get that there were some kind of statutes and some kind of rules involved in there, but it seemed like a mess that they were just kind of, you know, finagling along as they, you know, tried to figure out this last minute crisis. It didn't seem like they had a set plan in place, and there just needs to be a better plan and a better protocol. And to me, it starts with getting rid of the purse money only rule, except in very, very, in particular circumstances where a horse throws a shoe or something like that. The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Legacy Bloodstock. If you think that 50 years combined experience in the horse business could benefit your program, give Tommy or Wendy a call. They personally advise on each horse as if they were their own. Legacy has had great results so far. At Keeneland November, they offered a stakes place mare named Guacamole, who I remember from Mike Rapoli, who was in Fold Authentic, sold for $425,000. They've also had weanlings by First Crop sires Audible and Catalina Cruiser hit six figures. They'll be at barns 21 and 31 for the final few days of the sale. Have three horses in the Horses of Racing Age portion, which we talked about before. That's on Friday, so be sure to stop by and give Tommy or Wendy a visit, and definitely bet on their offerings in the last few days of Keeneland November. Last chances of the year. Last chance, that's major chances of the year for broodmares and weanlings and Horses of Racing Age, so get involved.
Yeah, and Joe, there was one horse in particular that's selling the last day at 35-35, an unbridled song mare named Evening Garden, who's in fold to First Year Stallion, Thousand Words, son of Pioneer of the Nile. And, you know, she is a half to Harmonious, who was a $625,000 grade one winner. So to have a chance to get one of the last unbridled song mares, that's a half to a grade one winner in fold to a First Year Stallion, that sounds like value to me in book five at Keeneland.
For sure. We'll be right back after this message from Legacy Bloodstock.
Being a small family business, I guess we're part of a dying breed. We're really grateful for the people that entrust us. We know it's a huge responsibility.
We're always with your horse every step of the way. When it comes to being at the sales ground, showing your horses, we are with your horse.
Just driving up and down the road every day, there's not a time that I don't look out and feel a responsibility to the sport, the animal, the people that come to invest in the game. I want to see as many people enjoy this sport as they possibly can, because we do have the most beautiful sport in the world.
I meant to mention in the last segment, the Bobby Flay, we actually talked to him about it. He was talking about having alternates in like the pick fours and pick fives, which makes sense too. As if you go on, if you like play like an online tournament, you have a pick and then you have an alternate pick in case of a scratch. Like there's no reason that they can't, you know, fix the wagering machines to do that.
Right.
All right.
and then and have like the automatic default be the favorite. So for people who don't know, they would
exactly. It's people who don't pick an alternate. At least then you have the opportunity to, you know, to say who you would prefer in case of a scratch.
Okay.
Just wanted to mention before we go, we lost English Channel over the past week. It was, you know, for my money, one of the best turf stallions in America. I think it was basically him and Kitten's Joy. And also a horse who, you know, he was one of the first great Todd Pletcher turf horses I can think of. Like a Todd Pletcher at that point, you know, in the mid-2000s was almost exclusively a dirt trainer. English Channel, I remember winning money on him in his debut. Really liked him that day. He went on to win the United Nations, the Woodford Reserve, the Joe Hirsch Turf Classic, the Breeders' Cup Turf over the wettest turf course you'll ever see in American racing at Monmouth that day in 2007. They will, you know, if that wasn't the Breeders' Cup, they wouldn't have run on that turf for weeks. That's how much rain it got. And English Channel was not quite fancy because all the, everybody assumed all the Euros were going to come in and just sweep through over that boggy turf course. He won it. He also won the United Nations and the Joe Hirsch again. So that's six grade one wins. He made over $5 million. And like I said, has become a terrific turf stallion as well. He was at Calumet, started at Calumet Farm in 2008. So he will be missed, especially as a turf influence. So rest in peace, English Channel, and condolences to everybody who cared for him over the past 15 years or so. So that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. Keeneland November is still going on. You got chances to bid on their offerings through this Friday, finishing with the Horses of Racing Age sale. So good luck to John and everybody who's buying and selling. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Bobby Flay, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Petruniak, and our editors, Anthony LaRocca, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Nathan Wilkinson. Thank you so much for watching. We'll see you next week.